Well, hi everybody. My name is Rick Bradley, and I'm in Wichita, Kansas. And today is December 5th, 1994. And this interview for the Society for American Baseball Research Oral History Committee is with Forrest Woody Jensen. Woody, why don't you go ahead and start off with the story you're just about to tell?
This is Woody Jensen from Wichita, Kansas. I was 17 years I played baseball, and 10 of it with the Pittsburgh Pirates. And it was a wonderful life, and I always remember particularly some things that happened. And, of course, the one that sticks out in my memory more than anything else was a ball game that we played in Braves Field on a Sunday afternoon. And it's so long ago, it's pretty hard to remember. But, you know, in the Braves Field, in left field, was the bleachers that run about 20 rows up behind the left field fence. And behind that fence was a railroad track where every afternoon, along about the fifth, sixth inning, a big old freight train would come tearing by there and puffing and blowing. Well, one day, or this day when we were playing this ball game, in the sixth inning, I believe it was, and Wally Berger was up at bat, a great Braves outfielder, a home run hitter. And he hit a ball over the left field fence, and all I could do was watch it. And as that ball went over the fence, that freight train was going by, and just that ball went down over the wall, the freight train come by, and that ball, of all things, went down in the smokestack of that locomotive. Now, just as it went down there, this locomotive gave a great big puff, blew the ball out of the smokestack, blew it into the ballpark, and Wally Berger caught it, or I caught it for a home, caught it for the out. Now, that was one of the greatest plays I've ever seen or participated in. I get all tangled up when I think about it.
What did Wally think about that?
Well, it's such a goofy deal that I didn't know we had some strange things happen in baseball. There was another event there, that continuation of this same doggone play. Now, this was the third out, but we had this thing happen again about a year later, when we're playing them, and odd as it seems, Wally Berger was up bat again with two outs along the sixth, seventh inning. But the Braves had the bases full, two outs, and Wally at bat, and he hit a long fly ball out to left field. And I caught it. And just as I caught the ball, someone in the bleachers threw a piece of dry ice. And it hit my glove just as I caught the ball, and the piece of the dry ice was about the size of a baseball, and it dropped to the ground. Well, it's the third out, the inning's over, the base runners are running around the bases, the crowd, about 20,000 people out there, were screaming and hollering, and I'm standing here with the ball in one hand, this piece of dry ice, and the glove in the other. And I come on, start in, and Bill Clem, that great National League umpire, he comes tearing out there. And I said, "What's going on, Bill?" He said, "Well, you dropped the ball." I said, "I didn't drop the ball. Here's the ball in my glove." And I showed him the ball. He said, "Well, what in the world happened?" I said, "Well, here, just as I caught the ball, this character in the bleachers threw this piece of dry ice and hit my glove and it went down. That's what it was, and I picked it up, and here it is." Oh, well, he looked at the dry ice, he looked at the glove, and he says, "The batter's out." Well, that was quite a deal for a while. It was pretty well known, and about 15 years later, I'm in Wichita, at this one of these national tournaments. And I'm out enjoying the ball game. I get a tap on the shoulder and I turned around. Fella says, "Hey," he says, "you remember that dry ice in Boston?" And I said, "My gosh, 15 years ago." I said, what? Yeah, he says, "How do you know about it?" And I was at a loss of words. I didn't know. He says, "I'm the fella that threw the ice." I said, "This is not possible." But he told me all about it, so I'm sure it was him. And he came down to my bowling lanes the next day, and we really had quite a visit. And that was just a little story of life that it's hard to believe, but it's an actual happening.
Real name is your given name is Forrest, and your nickname is Woody, which is a takeoff, I'm sure, of your first name, and also growing up in Washington. But do you remember who first laid that nickname on you?
How I got the name?
Yeah.
Well, when I first started playing baseball, they started a summer pro league in Washington, right outside of Seattle. There was Everett, Washington, and Chehalis, Washington, Kelso, and a six-team league, and we played every Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Well, when they started that league, I wasn't doing anything. I just graduated from high school, and they were having tryouts, so I went on out, and I tried out with them, and lo and behold, they offered me $100 a month to play baseball Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. I thought, that's pretty good for an 18-year-old kid, so I immediately signed up then, and that's how I began to get started in baseball. Well, we played in the Timber League. They call it the Timber League, and my first name being Forrest, and come from Washington. Well, when I joined Los Angeles in the Coast League, some sport writer put it together and just made the name Woody, and so I've been called that ever since. So I don't hardly answer to Forrest anymore. I don't know what they mean.
Tell me about growing up. It's Bremerton, Washington, right? Just tell me about growing up. What did your dad do and things like that?
Oh, I was born in Bremerton, Washington, and when I was 7 years old, we moved over into the Yakima Valley. My father had bought a fruit ranch over there, and I grew up then about a fruit ranch about 60 miles east of Yakima, Washington. And I spent all the time then from 7 till I was, about a junior in high school.
What did your dad do for a living?
Oh, my father was from Denmark, and he came over to the United States in about 18, he was here 6 months, and he got off the boat, went directly to Nebraska, and wasn't there a month till he joined what they called the Nebraska Volunteers, and he wound up in the Spanish-American War in Cuba, and then he'd gone to the Philippines, and then back to the U.S. after the insurrection, whatever, what they call the Philippines War. And he went from there to Omaha, where he met my mother, and then they moved to Seattle, Bremerton, where I was born, and he was a custodian of the high school there for years till he bought this fruit ranch. He was a nice little old Danish fellow that come over here when he was about 18. Yeah.
Well, you weren't just a baseball player when you were growing up. You played a little basketball, too?
Yeah, we didn't. Well, I was quite a basketball player. Of course, now they wouldn't let you out there, but anybody under 7 feet, they call them shorty now. So that wasn't. But basketball was my game. We didn't play baseball in high school because we only had 16 boys in school. So we didn't have any, but I always liked when Seattle was right close, and they were in the Coast League. And every chance I had, I'd go out there and watch them. And that's how I got started in baseball. I went up there one day, didn't have 50 cents, so I went to the door and I said, I come out to work out with the Seattle, I forget what they call them, Rainiers, I guess it was, on account of the owner had a Rainier brewery in town. So as I come, well, the fella said, oh, you're a gate man. He says, you're kidding. You get out of here. No, I said, get my work out. Well, it's okay. I'll go. And he went in and got the manager, and out he come and want to know what it's all about. And I come out to work out. Well, all right, come on. So I went in, I worked out with him, and I guess it looked pretty good because after time for the ball game to start, then of course I was through, but I got in for nothing, and that's all I wanted. So he invited me back the next day. Well, fine. Well, in the Coast League, they played 7-game series. They played every day in the week except Monday, and to make that up, they played a doubleheader on Sunday. And that was fine. I played there all week, then, or worked out all week until Friday. And then I told them after Friday I had to go on back and play baseball on Saturday and Sunday. And then, darn if he didn't ask anyone know if I wanted to sign up and go to California with him. Well, that to an 18-year-old kid that had never been outside 100 miles from Seattle was something. So, oh, I couldn't. He said, I'll give you $300 a month. Well, for a kid that never had over $20 in his life, you might say, in his pocket, that was really something. Go to California. Well, I said, that sounds good, but I'll have to go talk to my father first. So I went and talked to my father, and I said, well, that's all right. But he says, tell him that you have to have $350 a month in your transportation home. So I says, okay, back I go. I said, well, I'll sign up with you for $350 a month in my transportation home. Well, what's all this? I said, well, I might get down there in a couple of weeks. You might release me, and then I'm down in California. How'll I get home? Well, all right. So I got $350 a month and a ticket back home after the season, and that's how I got started in baseball. So then I went from there. I was so green, I didn't know anything about baseball. And they farmed me out to Pocatello, Idaho. And then when I came back, they sold me to Newark or to Wichita the next year. And I went to Wichita in 29, broke my leg, didn't play anymore, went in 30. And was with Pittsburgh from 1931 till 1940. And then I went over in the International League for a couple of years with Jersey City and with Montreal. And then when the war broke out, I quit. I went out to Boeing during the war and run the recreation department. And we had about 30 ball clubs, so that kept me pretty busy. Of course, I had to play with what they call the Boeing Bombers, too, that played in that Dumont Circus, I call it, the World Series of Summer Pros. And we had a pretty good ball club. We won the thing. So that was about the extent of my baseball, but that's when I then got interested in bowling on account of the recreation department. We had about 100 bowling teams, and we monopolized the whole every alley in town and practically run the public off. But anyway, that's how I got started in bowling, and been in it ever since, the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. When you were just a kid, what positions did you play other than outfielder? Was that all you played?
Yeah, I was an outfielder because I threw left-handed, and the only place you could play right or the left-hander could play was either the outfield pitch or first base.
Mm-hmm. So it was just outfield.
Yeah, so I was pretty fast and a good outfielder, so it seemed like my natural position, and I never had a chance. I couldn't pitch, didn't have good enough arm. Mm-hmm. And first base and never had an opportunity to play there, which would have been fun.
Did you have, when you were growing up, did you have a favorite baseball player?
No, I never given it any thought. I was going to, might say, be a school teacher. Mm-hmm. I went to college 1 year, this 1 year before I was playing ball, and this is the off season, so I got tangled up in baseball with that, and that $100 a month, it was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And that's actually how I got into baseball. I had no idea about playing professional ball.
What did your family think about you making a career playing ball?
Well, my mother died when I was 9 years old, and I had a brother and two sisters. And my father, that was all right with him. He was just a little old Danish man. He didn't know baseball from a football, but it was all right with him.
Mm-hmm. You talked about signing, you eventually signed with the Seattle Rainiers, is that correct? Is that where you signed your first professional contract, or were you scouted by anybody, or how did you...
No, my first one was with L.A., Los Angeles.
All
right. Yeah. And I went down south with them then, and I think that was really a trip to heaven, you might say, for a kid that never been anywhere. Of course, it was good. I was just green as grass. I remember one of the first things first ball game I played, the hitter ahead of me said he wanted to, or behind me, he said, "You want my hit and run?" And I said, "Well, hit and run." I said, "Hell, I always run when I hit the ball." That's how much I knew about baseball.
But there was no scout really that signed you? Do you remember the name of the guy that was...
No, I can remember once when we were playing in this Timber League after the first month. I had a wonderful start, and we're playing this. We're playing a team in the league, Longview, Washington, and there was a fella come down before we were playing this ball game, and he says, "Now he says, I'm a scout for the New York Yankees," and I hardly knew who the New York Yankees were. He said, "Somebody's going to try to sign you," he says, "and don't sign anything until you see me again." He says, "I've got to go." He says, "I'll come back in a week or two, and we'll see if we can't get together." I said, "Yeah," and then I promptly forgot about it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't pay attention to it because I didn't have any idea about professional ball. So I just drifted into it.
Any, just about not signing with the Yankees, are there any regrets about maybe you could have played with the Yankees in the 30s instead of the Pirates?
Oh, if they had, yeah, that would have been wonderful, wouldn't it? That little 290 feet to that right field fence in Yankee Stadium where there's big old pop flies or home runs or playing in Pittsburgh, where the fences were 400 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a bad break, I say. Not that I was a great ball player, but my record would have been much better if I'd have been able to play in some other ballpark. And it wasn't the fact that a big ballpark, but the thing was that Pittsburgh always had so many left-handed hitters, and they had the two Wehner brothers, both Hall of Famers, both left-handed hitters, both outfielders, and no matter what you did, even though 1 year, I say very proudly that I out-hit both of them, that is only 1 year, but nevertheless, I was a pretty good hitter, but no matter what I did, I was in a situation where every year they wanted a right-handed hitting outfielder. And every spring training, that for 10 years this went on, they would bring three or four, five left-handed hitting outfielders in there to left field. Now imagine how you would feel like that. No matter what you did, well, you were on the outside. But I couldn't get away from them. I told them, get rid of me, do something. I don't want to sit here like this. But I couldn't get away from them.
You know, for a guy that seemed to come into baseball kind of, I don't want to say as a lark, but kind of late, you certainly were a pretty good hitter in the minor leagues.
Yeah, but...
Well, the numbers are pretty good here. 326 and 302 in the two leagues in 1929. And then in 1930, with Wichita, you hit 354 and led the league. So that's not too bad.
Well, some years, you know, that ball dropped in, and then other years it just wouldn't. Now, this, my best average with Pittsburgh was 324.5, I believe it was. And the following year, I really hit the ball better than I did the year before and wound up hitting 280-something. Mm-hmm. But everything I hit seemed to be right at them.
Do you remember your first day in the big leagues? That would have been about April 31, I guess. Do you have any memories about that?
1931. We opened the season with the St. Louis Cardinals. I remember that game, yeah. And I got such a bang out of it that, of course, that was my first big league ball game. And, naturally, I didn't play. And I remember the ball club sitting there on the bench was jockeying Jim Bottomley, the Cardinal first baseman. And we played them, as I remember, a four-game series. And Bottomley, he got no base hits the first day. He didn't get any the second. And then the ball club started counting. 0-8, 0-9. And our dugout first base was behind first base. And every time Jim hit a ball and come down, and the fellas, some of our jockeys would get on him. And poor old Jim went about 14 times at bat before he got his first base hit. I never had forgotten that.
back in 1931, when you were brand new on the team, young guy, how did the veterans on the team treat you? Were they happy to see you, or did they consider you a guy that was taking one of their...
No, they were a good bunch of fellas. I'd never heard any of you. Lots been written about the olden days when the old-timers just tried to run the young ones off. They were all good fellas.
Tell me about that. We talked about this before we turned on the tape. I wanted to ask you about Barney Dreyfus. And you, was it Barney Dreyfus? You're telling me the story about the mail in the letter? He needed the three stamps? Did that happen with him? Or?
No, Barney Dreyfus, he was in 1931. He died right after the 31 season. Yeah, his son had died a year before. Yeah. So this letter deal was about 1934.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and tell that story again so we can have it on the tape.
Well, I went by the office one morning. I should preface that by saying, you know, this was during the Depression, and times were tough. We were allowed $3.75 a day meal money when we were on the road. Of course, we paid our own expenses when we were in your home field. And if we went over that 3 6 bits a day, say $4, they'd take quarter out of your paycheck. Well, I'm walking down the ballpark one morning, and I had a letter. And in those days, in the 30s, a letter cost a little 3 cent stamp, a little old red stamp. And I stopped the office and got a stamp and put it on the letter and mailed it. The payday comes. I get my check, I look at it, and it's 3 cents short. A little notation on there, 3 cents for a stamp. Now that just showed you how tough it was. And the thing I could never understand was that when we went to Boston, they allowed us $4 a day. 25 cents more we could spend for a meal in Boston we could in New York or Philadelphia or anywhere else.
The high cost of living, huh? No, we were talking about this a little bit too. Tell me about the pay cut you took to get back up to the major leagues. This is right around 31, 32.
Oh. Well, in 31, when, well, like I said, I knew I wouldn't get to play with the Wainers in right field and center field, and Adam Komorowski at that time was the left fielder, a right-handed hitter who hit 330 the year before. So I could have been Ty Cobb. I'd have never gotten in that outfield. So I raised so much hell about it that the 1st of June, they sent me over to Newark in the International League. And as I said, I was getting $500 a month at Pittsburgh, and when I got to Newark, you have to sign another contract for the International League, and the business manager asked me how much I was making. I said $600 a month. I don't know why I said it, but anyway, $600. That's fine, so I signed a contract for $600. I was there the month of June till and 4th of July, and then Pittsburgh recalled me. And I go back there, have to go back to my $500 a month. So I'm probably the only ball player that ever went from the minors to the majors and took a cut. So it was kind of funny in a way. But
you mentioned Adam Komorowski. Did he have a bad temper?
No, he was a nice little Polish boy from Scranton, Pennsylvania. And he'd played at Wichita, too. No, Adam was a good hitter, but he went all to pieces. He had that 1930, had a nice year, and then he lost it for some reason.
1932, you were only with the Pirates for 7 games. You spent most of the time at Newark, and when I had talked to you on the phone originally, you told me that that 32 Newark club was the best club you ever saw?
Oh, yes, 32, and I think it was probably the greatest minor league team ever put together. They say the 1935 Newark team was the best, but I don't know. It was hard to believe. We had an outfield in 32 at Newark. We never lost a series all year. We won the pennant by 20 games. Our outfield was Jess Hill, who hit 330 that year. And he played left field. Dixie Walker played center field and hit 354. And I played right field and hit 345. Now, Marvin Owen, all these names, you know, played third base. And he hit 320-something. Red Rolfe was a shortstop. And Jack Salsgaver was a second baseman. And Johnny Newman, who was a first baseman with Detroit for years, was the first baseman. And our catcher was Charlie Hargraves, who caught for the Pirates for years and others. And the lowest average in the team was 320. And they're on up outside of Hargraves, hit about 290. And the pitching staff was no celebrities, but yet they're all good pitchers. And I think it was the best minor league club I ever saw anyway. And we played Minneapolis in the Little World Series. And lo and behold, they beat us 2 out of 3 in the first 3 games in Newark, and we go to Minneapolis and murdered them the last 3 games and won the series. But all of that ball club, the whole ball club wound up in the big leagues for years.
Mm-hmm. 1933, you're back up with the Pirates. I think you were with the Pirates for the whole year, right, although you only played about half of the games. Is that a fair assessment?
Hmm?
Is that a accurate statement?
Yeah, 33.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fred Lindstrom came over from the Giants, I think, that year.
Oh, Lindstrom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he talk about, I know that there was, I don't want to call it a power struggle, but I know that right before that, him and, when after McGraw gave up the Giants' managing job, that he thought he was going to get it, and Bill Terry got it instead. Did Lindstrom ever talk about Terry?
No, he never said a word about it. Nothing was ever said about it. But he was that left-handed hitting outfielder, or right-handed hitting outfielder they wanted again. So there I am back, and I'm sitting on the bench again. It's kind of tough. And I hate to talk anything against Freddie, but it seems like the year he is with us, that every time they got a real tough pitcher out there, Freddie gets sick. Mm. He just couldn't play that day, so then I'd get to play. I never could get over that. But then they got Babe Herman one year, but he was a left-handed hitter too. But then that was, I think, in 1934. They traded Lindstrom to the Cubs, and we got Herman. Well, naturally, that sidelined me again. Yeah. But I don't know, Babe got hurt or something. I got in there, and they couldn't get me out for a while, so that's where I got going. And then they traded Herman off, so I was all right there, except that every year they wanted to get that right-handed hitting outfielder.
Wade Hoyt was your teammate for a little while.
Hoyt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he ever talk about playing for Connie Mack? Did he talk about those teams back in the late 20s, early 30s?
No, he didn't. I only remember one instance where he got on Cincinnati. They had I can't recall the name of the pitcher, but he was a jockey and very crude. I mean, he was on the other, he'd get on you for no reason at all and something, and he got on Hoyt one day. And I remember this because it's kind of certain things stick in your memory. But Hoyt, he gets mad, and he leaves our dugout, and he goes out in front of the Cincinnati dugout, and he looks into this fellow who's a pitcher. And he said, I'll never forget it. He said, you know, in one more word out of you, he says, I'm going in and put on my Yankee uniform and come out here and scare you to death. I don't know why. It was serious, and yet it was funny. Yeah, but Hoyt was a wonderful fellow. He was a good pitcher. But he did something that, and I never caught him, that little known, the pitcher's box, you know, is or the pitcher is 60 feet 1 inch from home plate to the pitcher's rubber, and Hoyt would pitch half his ball game about 6 to a foot ahead of that rubber, and they never caught him.
Hmm. When you were in the early 30s in Chicago, when you were playing there at Wrigley Field, did you ever see any gangsters? Ever see Capone or anybody at the ball?
I saw Al Capone once. He was there one day. Had that hat on, and he had a couple of bodyguards. I guess they were sitting next to him. Yeah, he was about 3 box seats over from our dugout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just sat there like a fan.
But you didn't meet him or anything.
Hmm?
You didn't get to meet him or?
No, hell no, we didn't.
Landis wanted you to keep away from him.
No, we actually didn't hardly know who he was or anything, except they pointed him out to him that that's Al Capone, that gangster or whatever he was. But paid. No, I went out to that by that place they had that St. Valentine's Massacre because I just wanted to see it. Mm-hmm. It's just a garage. So.
When you were... Well, let me put it this way. When you first started playing ball, was there either in the way you played the outfield or the way that you batted, either held the bat or stood or anything like that, was there anybody that you copied or did you do it all on your own?
Oh, you did it all at your own. I've often wondered the rest of my life, as long, and I always will, that when I started now, I'm not counting Los Angeles because, I was so doggone green. But starting at Pocatello, I hit 320-something the first part of that season when I went up there, and the next year hit 330-something. Then I come to Wichita, and I played 10 games, broke my leg, and then I played the... I told the manager, send me home and pay me half my salary, and then I'll come back next year. He said, no, I want you to stick around here, and maybe you can play the last month or 6 weeks or whatever it is. So I played the last 15 games, and I wound up hitting .302. Then in 30, I come back, and I led the league in hitting .354. Then I go to Pittsburgh, and then the time I was at 31, I can't count that season too much either, because I was sitting on the bench at Pittsburgh, and I was over at Newark for a month where I hit .333. And then I went back to Newark in 32 and hit .345. Mm-hmm. But when I joined Pittsburgh, like going from Pocatello to Wichita, I'd always hit from the end of the bat. You know, I was hitting my .330, .340, whatever, .350, whatever it was. And now here's one of the coaches at Pittsburgh, Jew Lenz,
okay,
that never hit .210 in his life. He says, son, you can't hit that. You can't hit that way. You got to choke up. Well, being a kid, you listen to all the coaches. I choked up the bat. I was lost for a long time. Yeah. It didn't occur to me to say, well, damn it, I come up through the minors hitting .340, .350. I the same fellows that are pitching here were in the minors too, and it's harder to hit in the minors than in the majors, because in the minors you got all these hitters or pitchers that you don't know where the ball is going to be, at your head or at your feet or over the heart of the plate. But in the big leagues, every pitch is somewhere around the plate. And even if you go and hit a bad ball, swing at a bad pitch, you can still hit the darn thing. No, you can't hit that way. And it's foolish me. Not have sense enough. So, not like today, it's, how much did you hit? That would shut them up. Well, I went along with it and choked up. Well, I think that took something away from me. Mm-hmm. I always thought so, and still do.
What kind of outfielder were you? Did you have a pretty good arm?
My arm wasn't too good, but the problem was being a left-handed hitter or a thrower.
Yeah.
When you're playing left field, a left-hander's arm or a throw is kind of go to the left a little bit, no matter how you threw it. So when I'm throwing in a runner on second base, and he's trying to score, and you're throwing right into him, and when he's on the third base side between there and home, your ball's going this way. Now any other field, you're throwing right field, let's say, your ball's going, you're throwing in. Out, perfect. So I had no trouble playing center field or right field, but left field, my throw would always, that was
kind of tail on you, huh?
Yeah, it was a trial, and it was a worry, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In 34 with Pittsburgh, we'll go back to playing ball again here. That was your, they got rid of George Gibson as a manager, and Pi Trainer took over.
34?
Yeah.
I guess so.
Well, first of all, what'd you think of George Gibson? Was he a pretty good manager?
Nah, he wasn't. I was trying to think. He was one of these guys that stuck with the old players, and just, he was an old-timer is what he was.
Mm-hmm.
He's very uneducated, a good fellow, but, I mean, he was just old-fashioned. The show was over. He must have been a friend of the owner or something. he'd play the same bunch every day, even if they're hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then Pi Trainer took over then. We talked a little bit about Dick Bartel before we turned the tape on, and Dick says in his book that Trainer was not a great team player. I guess before you showed up with the Pirates, when Bartel and Trainer were teammates. Trainer was playing third. Bartel was playing short. I guess Trainer would cut in front of him for ground balls. And when Dick brought it up to him, Pye told him to mind his own business and blah, blah, blah. What did you think of Trainer first as a player and then as a manager?
Well, of course, he was past his prime when we got there in 31. He still played third base, and undoubtedly was one of the great ones. He could do something that third baseman, just none of them could hardly do it. Some or other, he could dive after that ball behind the third base bag and come up with it and throw the runner out. Yeah, but he hurt his arm, I guess, somewhere along in 1930 or something. But he was, and I don't care if the world knows that he's probably the world's worst manager.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about 38 later on, but why do you say that?
Oh, did I tell you about the 38?
No, we'll say we'll talk about that later on, unless you just want to save it for then.
Oh, no, whatever you say. Oh, he just, I mean nothing. I mean, he's the one that coached at first base because he said that was a more important base than third base.
Yeah,
well, now, I never could quite figure that, because every manager, the best coach they got's always at third base because that's where the action is. There, your decisions are there. Anybody knows to first base, you just stay there till they hit the ball or you try to steal second, but your decisions is at second base, can the man score or not on a base hit? Yeah, that's an important coaching place there.
Pittsburgh in 34, that was the last major league team that repealed the Sunday Blue Laws, so you could finally play in Pittsburgh on Sundays. What did they, before they repealed them, what did they do?
Before that, they... the ball club had to leave town every Saturday night and play either in Cincinnati, Chicago, or St. Louis, Brooklyn. Never did go to Phillies because they couldn't play either. But the ball club would leave Saturday night and go to, say, Cincinnati and play Sunday and then come back and play Monday again home. And the visiting team would just have a Sunday off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of travel, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was a hardship for the ball club in a way that you had to leave town overnight and ride the Pullmans all night long, play and say Cincinnati again, and then get on the train, come back to Pittsburgh. And the other club is out there just resting up on Sunday or having a good time and taking out your girlfriends instead of you. So it worked a little hardship on the ball club.
In 34, I don't know if it was a rumor or if you know about this or not, but I'm going to ask you, was there any truth to the rumor that Bill Terry was trying to get Freddie Lindstrom back to the Giants and they were going to trade Hubble to the Pirates for Freddie Lindstrom?
Yeah,
did you ever hear about
that? I can remember just one little thing that some sport writer wrote, that how nice it had been if Pittsburgh had had a Hubble. Which, if we'd have had one pitcher like Hubble or Dean or Warnicki, we'll say, or somebody that could go in there and win that ball game for you, when you, no matter how good a club you are or who you were, if you lose two in a row, then have that fella go in there and pitch and win that ball game for you, like a Hubble or a Shoemaker. And it was good 20-game winners. We never had one. All those years, our two leading pitchers, I guess you'd have to call Bill Swift and Cy Blanton. And they win 17 and lose 13 or 14. Well, that's no better than a pitcher winning 20 and losing 20 or winning 10 and losing it. You can't win a pennant with 500 pitchers. No. So we never had that one to go out, what they call a stopper, that could go out there and win that game for you, stop that losing streak.
In 34, I guess the Pirates picked up Burley Grimes.
Yeah.
What kind of guy was he? I guess he was kind of a mean guy, wasn't he?
Oh, he was something. Old Burley. He joined us, I think, about the last 6 weeks or 2 months of the season. 34? Yeah, that's what it had to be. Well, he'd lost it. In fact, he moved to live in Wichita here. Oh, he was a surly type of fella. I mean, you didn't get to know him. And then yet, first time when he come to Wichita, he just ignored me completely. And the next time, he was a great friend. I mean, he was a funny fella. I never knew how to take him.
Mm-hmm.
He came to Wichita because he married an outfielder's widow, Freddie Brickell, who was with the Pittsburgh, and he lived here. And he very suddenly died, and the first thing we know, we're doggone if Burley Grimes didn't marry his widow. Amazing, that's what it was.
That's
how
fishy was going on.
Didn't even know they were in 1,000 miles of each other. But Burley was all right after you got to know him. Yeah.
Tell me about your recollections of the St. Louis Cardinals in 34, the Gas House Gang.
Oh, the old Gas House Gang. I'll tell you, one of the first impressions I got of them was when Martin and Drosher, were opening day in Pittsburgh 1 year. I guess it was 34, maybe somewhere in there. But anyway, opening day in Pittsburgh is about 38 or 40 degrees. It's cold. I put on both sweatshirts I had and a warm-up jacket, and I was still cold. But anyway, here comes the Cardinals out in Pittsburgh, down the right field line. You take a little right to go into the dressing rooms. In a kind of a, not a tunnel, but over underhang. And here comes the Cardinals, and we're looking up, and it's cold. Their dugout's on the third base side, and ours was on the first base side, so we wouldn't have to so long to run after we got thrown out at first. And they had to go all the way over to third base. That's quite a trip. Well, here comes the Cardinals. All of them had on their jackets. I mean, they're bundled up like we were. And here comes Pepper Martin. No jacket. His sleeves cut off to his shoulders. No sweatshirt. Just nothing but his blouse. And he's ready to play ball. So now, here, we play him again the 4th of July in Pittsburgh. It's about 100 degrees out there in July, just 4th of July, hot as it could be. And we don't have any sweatshirts or nothing. Here comes the Cardinals, and here's Pepper Martin, a great big woolen sweatshirt on. But that was our Pepper. He was quite, but they were quite a bunch. They fought among themselves, but they could play ball. Because Dizzy, I guess, was more or less of a disreputable sort in a team man, but me and Paul, as you know, Paul, he wouldn't say 12 words a year. He didn't have a chance with Dizzy.
Do you like this? You two get along good? Did everybody like Dizzy?
With them?
No, I'm just saying, did everybody just like him as a...
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was
he's the only fellow I hit two home runs off of in one game.
Mm-hmm.
And he, that was funny. My two of my wife's uncles come to St. Louis once to watch us. And I never forgotten that. I might say the high point of my career.
Mm-hmm.
Little Weiner was leading off, and I was hitting second. We always hit first, second, or third, the three of us. And Little Weiner, did he have a hell of a year? He think he won 30 games and lost four or five, and we beat him about damn near all of those.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Little Weiner, he gets up there and he hits one of those line drives, Trojan ropes, we call them, in the right center for two bases. And I can remember thinking, oh, gosh, hope I can hit one like that. And Dizzy wound up and thrown, I wound up and swung and hit it up on the roof in Sportsman's Park. And I go into my Babe Ruth home run trot around the bases. And I look up and the two uncles are up there. And one of them, he's telling everybody in the stand, that's my nephew, that's my nephew. Third inning, the same thing again. And I look up there, and where's Jack? He isn't there. And look around. He's over behind the Cardinal dugout telling them all about it. I never get over that.
How about Leo? How'd you get along with DeRocher? Did you like him?
DeRocher? Oh, he just a loud mouth. I just trying to think about that. Of course, we had a lot of fun those days riding fellas, you know. He can't. We'd ride him. Just like he'd get down to first base, you know. He was. Yankee got rid of him for going through the pockets of players in the dressing room. They traded him to Cincinnati or sold him to him. And we used to get him on that. He'd come down to first base, you know, and throw him out in front of him. Fellas, watch your pocketbook now, watch your purse, and zip up your wallet, and he'd get so damn mad. He was a loud mouth. But those are the kind baseball seem to get ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the ones that wound up the managers and something.
In 35, you finally started playing every day.
Hmm?
In 1935, you started playing every day, pretty much. That's the year you hit 324.
Yeah, there, 34 or 5, somewhere in there.
35 is what the book says.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple things I wanted to ask you. One of them was, that was the year that McPhail, I think it was Larry McPhail, started night baseball. Now, what did you prefer? Did you like playing during the day, or did you like playing during the night?
Oh, well, if there's absolutely no substitute for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that second no-hit game in Brooklyn that Vandermeer pitched.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we were playing he'd pitched, I guess it was a Philadelphia or Braves, and he pitched that first no-hitter in Cincinnati. And about 4 days later, we're playing the Giants in the Polo Grounds, and Cincinnati's playing Brooklyn the first night game. And we played in the afternoon, and then we immediately grabbed the subway and tore over to Brooklyn, about a 20-30 minute ride on the subway. And, of course, the park was packed, and we couldn't get a seat, so we went up in the press box and stood up for the whole doggone ball game. Darn if he didn't pitch another no-hitter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was quite a deal.
Well, the day after McPhail started with the night baseball, that was the day that Babe Ruth hit his last big hurrah. He hit the three home runs there at Forbes Field, and I know you were playing that day, so why don't you tell me about that?
Oh, golly, that was, I think, in May of 1935.
35.
35, yeah. Babe hit 3 home runs that day. He couldn't hardly wobble around the bases, but I'll be doggone if he didn't hit 2 over the screen. Oh, I'd say they went about 360 feet, and the last one, off of Guy Bush, hit clear up on the deck, the second deck. It must have gone at least 420 feet. Mm-hmm. And he had 3 home runs. He hit me a long fly ball in the left field. It was about 12 feet from the left field fence.
So he almost had 4.
Well, there would have been 4 if it had gone another 20, 25 feet.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there a...
But it still went 360 feet, you might say. Yeah.
Was there a pregame meeting about talking about how to pitch to Ruth? And Guy Bush had been talking about when he pitched against him in the 32 series. He said that the way to get Ruth out was with sinker balls. And then Ruth, I think Ruth hit 2 of his home runs off of Guy Bush. Do you remember that meeting?
Oh, I remember the meeting, but I don't remember that too much about it. I know Guy, when he hit that home run, Guy went over. He left the pitcher's mound when Babe hit third base and trotting home, and Guy went over and took his hat off and bowed to him. Yeah, that was the last game he played. They say that at that time, that new liner, Normandy,
mm-hmm.
was on a maiden trip from London to New York, and it was docking the next day, and he wanted the day off to go see it. Just a big kid, and the Braves wouldn't let him, so he quit.
So he got mad and quit.
Went anyway. I had to admire him. I'll tell you that just... I mean, the history behind it, and what undoubtedly I could hit that ball the way he did. I don't know.
Did you? How well did you know him? Did you? How well did you know Ruth? Just a couple of months he was in the National League. Did you go up and talk to him at all? Or?
Well, one day, Yankee played an exhibition game with him one year in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they come out of the. They come through our dugout to go over there, and of course they said, "Truth." I said, "Hello, kid." He said, "Hi, kid," and all that something. So I said, "Well, I have some fun a little later on." I walked out third base or first base, put near to the base, and the Babe was fooling around there. "Hey, come on over here." He come over, and I don't know what the hell is. So anyway, the crowd began to murmur and talk, and finally he left. I went back to the dugout, and I don't know, Bill Swift or somebody said, "Oh, what was all that about?" And I said, "What's the crowd cheering about?" I says, "They all want to know who the hell that fellow was with Woody Jensen." And he didn't speak to me for 2 weeks.
That's a good story. That was the year that Babe Herman showed up, 35. Was he still pulling his usual bag of tricks? Was he just as goofy when he was with you guys as when he was with the Dodgers?
Who?
Babe Herman.
I think Babe, when he's with us, he went over to Cincinnati. No, I don't know whether he wound up with Brooklyn or not. Later on during the war, I think he came back mm-hmm. there for part of a season. But he left us, went to Cincinnati. Yeah.
Well, I thought he was the, wasn't he one of the guys, of course I don't know everything about this game, but I thought back in the, maybe in the early 30s, I thought he was with Brooklyn. And I thought there was a story about he was one of the 3 guys that wound up on third base at one time.
I was just thinking of that.
They used to say that Brooklyn fans would say, "We've got 3 guys on base," and the Brooklyn fans would say, "Which base?"
Yeah, well, they had a, I don't know who they were playing, but it doesn't matter. They had a fellow named Bissonnette, who was first baseman. And he got on first base, and Desi Vance was the next hitter. was the next. He was the next hitter. Anyway, they both got on bases. It winds up that the bases are full, and Vance is on second base. I forget who's on first, but it doesn't matter. And Babe Herman's at the bat, and he hits a long fly ball against the left or right field fence. And it looks like it might hit it and might be caught, so the runner don't know what to do. But anyway, the minute they saw that it hit the wall, well, at third base, it fell on third. I don't know what happened, but he went about halfway to home, and he decided that the ball had been caught or something, or it wasn't going to hit the wall. So he goes back to third base. Dazzy Vance, who's on second, he's rounding third base. He's going to score. And Herman was the one on first base. Yeah, he's all the time, he's tearing around the bases. Yeah. And he's tearing around the bases. Well, now, Bissonnette, who is on third, he heads back to third base. He's on third base. Dazzy Vance, he was on second. He had rounded third. He goes back to third base. Now, Herman, he's the base runner. He saw the ball wasn't caught. He tears in there, and he slides into third. Now, all three of them are on third base. Well, the third baseman, he tags so-and-so, tags so-and-so. And then here's Babe standing on the bag. He says, what are you doing here? And he says, Babe says, I'm going back to second. And so he stepped off the bag, and they tagged him out. And it did a triple play. I don't think I ever saw a triple play.
Did Tony Cuccinello ever get you with the hidden ball trick?
No. I guess he pulled it once or twice.
I guess he's pretty good at it from what I read.
Yeah. No, he never, not that I know of. He and Al Lopez kept his funny things. When Al went to Brooklyn, he was with Brooklyn, then he went to Boston. One day we're playing him in Pittsburgh, and somebody is on first base, and Waddy Watkins, left-handed pitcher of Brooklyn. Pretty good pitcher, too, and a southerner. He winds up firing the ball. He had a man on first, and he decided to steal second. Well, of course, the pitcher will always get down, and Al, he winds up fires the ball, and Waddy's down this like this, and the ball hit him right here and knocked him back over. He always had a big chew of tobacco in his mouth, and he come up and splitting that out. he was a funny fella. They had some really funny fellas in those days.
Let's see, well, I'm going to flip through this book here. How about Red Lucas? I guess he was quite a character, wasn't he?
Red was the funniest fella I ever knew in my life. He was really the cream of the crop. He was the best fella. Southern fella from Nashville. Yeah, he was. He loved to hit against him, but try to get any base hits. I mean, he'd hit that corner like that all day long on you, and you'd just do your damnedest to try to pull that ball or something, but you just, finally, I didn't try to. I just tried to poke it between third base and the shortstop. But he was uncanny control. He was with Cincinnati all those years, but, nobody knew of him because, hell, he had a lousy ball club. He comes over with us and wins 15 and loses 4. Yeah.
How about Mungo, Van Lingle Mungo? How hard did he throw the ball?
Oh, Mungo was, he was tough to hit. It used to be that we'd have a club meetings before the ball game, and I would tend to go over the lineup. How are you going to pitch this fella in, and where to play him? And then the pitcher try to do that, and the fielders would try to do that. But Mungo was one of these guys that, I mean, he'd start out firing that ball just as hard as he could, as long as he could. He didn't have the brains of a monkey, but he threw that ball hard, I mean, with that arm he had. So we would take him and what, dude, nobody swinging a pitch until you got two strikes on you. Let him pitch. He'd lose a little bit off of that fastball. And along about the seventh, eighth inning, time after time, then we'd start picking on him, and we'd beat him game after game that way. But no use trying to let him pitch. So he'd probably throw 120 pitches by the sixth inning. Yeah.
Was he the hardest thrower you ever saw?
No, I don't. I would say Dizzy was about as fast, but Mungo was a little bit. Mungo was tougher because he threw a little more overhand. Diz was about three quarters. Mm-hmm. Mungo was there, and he had a better curveball. Or Dean didn't have any curveball, you might say. He had what we called a wrinkle. He was proud of his wrinkle, he said. But Dizzy was just fastball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's a wrinkle? Just a little cheap curveball or a nothing curve? Or?
A nothing curve.
Yeah.
It's like they used to say the term, a slider comes in.
Yeah.
I think Heine Meine with Pittsburgh started that up. He had no curveball either. He had, I could say, maybe break that much. He called it his slider. Because he's ashamed, I guess, they call it a curve.
One way to look at it. People portray or paint Paul Wehner as a real drinker, as a big alcoholic, but that wasn't really true, was it?
I would call him a drinker, but I wouldn't call him an alcoholic. He would drink. I know that first year or the second year at Pittsburgh, there was about five of us lived in an apartment, Coronado Apartments, I remember. And, of course, it's during Prohibition. And they were pretty good drinkers, especially in 31 or 2. Somewhere, I don't know exactly, too long ago, but they'd buy these 5-gallon tins of wood alcohol and bring it in, and they'd get Coca-Cola or soft drink and spike it. They'd drink that stuff. Yeah, and they drank pretty good, but Paul never, they always make stories up about that, but He drank, but I wouldn't say he drank excessively. Lloyd didn't drink much. He drank a little beer, and that was all.
The following year, in 36, you're still playing regular. In fact, you mentioned that you thought you hit the ball better in 36 than you did in 35, even though your average was 40 points less. But you set a record that obviously will hold up for all time. It was 154 game season, you had 696 at bats. And one of the most amazing things about that, I think, is that in all those at bats, you only walked 16 times and you only struck out 19 times.
So yeah.
Pretty good bat control. And you.
One of the biggest reasons why I've never done any walks was that I'm always hitting the head of the two wieners. And there was no way to get a walk. They would keep you off the bases, so the wieners couldn't do so damn much damage. And I get so damn mad at times. Now, here's Big Jim Weaver, 6'8", pitching for us, and he couldn't hit you if you walked across home plate. Yet one day we're playing, he gets two walks, and I'll be damned if I could. I couldn't even get one. No, I only got 16 walks, so... after about half the season, there was no point in me taking any 2-0s and 3-1s, so I'd just swing away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Archie Vaughn was different. Many a time, while Archie was probably as good a hitter that ever lived, game after game, he'd stand up at that plate with a winning run on second or third base, 2 balls and 0 strikes, 3 balls and 1 strike, and take the next one right here and get a base on ball.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And poor old Gus Sewer have to come up behind him and try to drive in that run that you might say all Archie had to do is swing it back, but he wouldn't do it. He'd take the walk every time. Always kind of held him against it a little bit, because he's your power, and it didn't seem fair that you couldn't get him to swing. Not if he could get that base on balls.
In July of 36, the Phillies come to town, and Chuck Kline hit 4 home runs in 1 game against you guys. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I remember 4 of them right down the line. But it was really remarkable there because, you know, Chuck in Philadelphia, that little old fence there, just said about big as this room, that ballpark. You know, he hit 40, 45 home runs. Nice little pop flies. Just, I used to sit there and say, gee, I wish I could play here. Yeah, because that little old pop fly, that home run there looked like it went 9 miles over the fence. It was a big out in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
So they traded him over to, or they, I don't know, the trade him or sold him to the Cubs, because the poor Nugent, the owner of just shoestring enterprise, had to sell any good ball player to keep enough money to run the ball club. He sends Chuck over to Chicago, and I think he hit about 8 home runs that year.
Mm-hmm.
They sent him back to Philadelphia a couple of years later, and he went back to hitting his 35, 40 home runs. So ballparks make a big difference.
We talked a little bit about Jewel Enns trying to change your batting style, making you choke up. What kind of instruction? It seems like nowadays they have a bullpen coach, they have a hitting coach, they have this coach, that coach. What kind of instruction, at least from coaches, did you get when you were playing?
None.
None?
None at all. Nobody. We had Honus Wagner there, but he was on a pension, you know. He was in the sporting goods business in Pittsburgh for years, but during the Depression went busted, so the ball club, to put him on, he took care of the balls during batting practice, and that was that. And tell stories.
Mm-hmm. And that was
he could tell some that, he could tell you some that, like that smokestack deal.
Mm-hmm.
He'd tell my favorite is that he was a great hunter, and he said he always hunted in the fall, and he had a bird dog that was just out of the world, smartest dog ever lived. He talked for hours about it. He said one day he's out in the field, and he says, that dog came to a point, and he said, I was out of gun range, but that dog stood right at point. He said, I finally got up close, fairly close to him, and he said, all of a sudden, that dog lifted his paw, and a quail flew up. And he says, I got it. He says, about a minute later, he said, raise his paw, and another quail got up. He says, I got it. He says, the third time. Then he says, the fourth time, he raised his paw and 2 quail jumped up. And so you know how smart that dog was? He just tested me on a single quail, and he wanted to see how I was on doubles. Yeah, and he could tell those damn stories by the hours. He would never buy a sack of tobacco. And a lot of us chewed beech nut then.
Mm-hmm.
10 cents a nice big pack of beech nut, you know. So he'd always come up and, boy, how about a chaw? well, I'd give him a chew, and a chew to him with half the sack. Well, we go on this Eastern road trip again for 2 weeks, and we come back. And I know, well, honest, I'll fix him this time. So I get a full sack of beach stone, dump it all out. I go out in front of the grandstand where these old cigar butts, cigarette butts, old chews, I guess, that laid out there in that hot July sun, and all just terrible. And I picked them up and ground them up and filled my sack full of them and sealed it all up and fine, put it in my pocket, and I'll see what happens. And sure enough, here comes Honus after so long. How about a chaw, boy? Yeah, sure. I give it to him. I expected. I was on tiptoes, ready to take out. He took about half of it. And thank you, boy. And he patted me his shoulder. Away he went. To this day, I've never heard a word about it. I was disappointed. Oh, he was something. He could tell them damn stories, and if you didn't believe him, he'd get mad and walk away. So everybody would sit and listen and all laugh, and he'd tell the damnedest things. That, I don't know where he got them.
I think your son was telling me about the Pirates trained out in the spring training was out in California, and
San,
then you
San Bernardino.
And then you was it with the White Sox that you would.
Yeah.
Kind of what I'm called barnstorm, but you'd work your way back.
Yeah.
And there was, I know Gus Sewer is a buddy of yours, but there was a story about he was walking around on top of a train.
Oh, Gus. Yeah, Gus. Well, that was back in Boston. We were going from New York to Boston. We hit some railroad station there and stopped, and right across the track, Gus was there. One of the most comical fellows you ever looked at. Yeah. We're just sitting there in a Pullman, just looking out the window like this, and there's a railroad track right here, the next track, and a big old freight train was coming along and stopped. And pretty soon, Lucas or somebody says, "Hey, look." And we look, and here's Gus up on top of this boxcar.